This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, there is no policy on which tax foreclosed houses in Wayne County are saved from auction.
It's no light thing to take people's properties away and sell them.
We hear from a judge who might have made a legal path for LGBTQ people to go to court for discrimination, even though there are no civil rights protections for them in Michigan.
You know, I'm an African-American male, and I know how it feels to be discriminated at times, and so I believe any discrimination is bad.
We hear about a book on how the Detroit Riverwalk and the jewels along it came to be.
People started saying, well, why can't we have public access, greater public access to the Detroit River?
And then we turned the cheers on Stateside into a book.
It inspired me to make a cocktail based on the very first cocktail we ever made on Cheers and the very first cocktail that's printed in the book.
Plus our political commentators on the unemployment fraud scandal. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later on the program, we'll talk to the author of a new book about Detroit's riverfront and the many changes it's seen over the years. But first, what policies determine the fate of home foreclosures in Wayne County? It's a pretty simple question, but it turns out the answer is not so simple. Jerry Paffendorf is with Loveland Technologies. He asked through the Freedom of Information Act what policies Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sabree's office uses to determine how some tax delinquent homes get pulled from auction and how it's determined others are auctioned. Jerry Paffendorf joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lester. It's good to be here.
So what did you really want to know about the treasurer's policy?
Well, some folks might know that Wayne County and Detroit have foreclosed on more than 150,000 properties over the last decade or so. So it's just an awful lot of homes that have been seized for failure to pay back taxes and auctioned to the highest bidder. And about 50,000 of these homes were occupied. And if you compare Detroit to the rest of the state, it has about 2/3 of all foreclosures in the state, and it has about 7% of the population of Michigan. So the situation is really off the charts. And the law that the treasurer follows to conduct foreclosure is pretty clear in its timeline. Basically says when you're 3 years tax delinquent, the treasurer takes your property, auctions it, and the foreclosure is supposed to happen on March 31st of that third year. So, you know, as a nerd who's been trying to follow this and trying to advocate for better outcomes, reduce foreclosures, help people keep their homes, all of this, I got really interested that the system wasn't really like changing. Like people could see that it was a problem, but they weren't really doing a lot on the legal or policy side to say, how are we going to cut this out? Seeing that, you know, I started to investigate like, okay, these are crushing numbers. How is this actually working? Are things being filed on time? Are they actually following the state law, the timelines of the state law? And that's when things got really interesting. So I did a bunch of FOIA requests. I got like the actual documents that the treasurer submits to a judge who rules the properties foreclosed. And these documents are quite binding. I mean, this is a legal ruling of tax foreclosure. But the treasurer doesn't go and file these foreclosures. They kind of keep it in a, what I'll call a secret system, because nobody knows how it works. You basically have a spreadsheet internally. And after the foreclosure dates, they allow some people to redeem their property. So some people can come in and pay late. Sometimes they accept partial payments. Sometimes they make people pay the whole thing. And then some people aren't allowed to redeem their properties late. And so looking at this, and I just really needed to understand what discretion and what power does the treasurer have to choose which properties get foreclosed and which don't, because the evidence makes it clear that they do not follow the law as it's laid out. So what decision-making process are they following?
Sure, you wanted to see the policy.
You've got to see it when you're taking people's property and at this scale.
So what were you told when you made that request?
Well, so I filed the FOIA asking for their official policy on what they choose to foreclose on and when. And I received, after you know an initial ask for more time and a delay, I received a denial to my FOIA saying that the office certified that the records do not exist. And they said, if you want to appeal the denial, you can do so to County Executive Warren Evans. So I sent my denial to Warren Evans' office. And after a little while, I just got a note back earlier this week saying that they'd spoken to the treasurer's office to confirm that the treasurer has no formal tax foreclosure policy. And so I wrote back to them asking, what do you do as a citizen, as a resident, when you've gone through all these channels, all these steps over, you know, months, more than a year at this point, just to say that we can't give you an answer because we don't have anything formal? What is the next step to understand what's actually happening? That's the question that I have right now.
Well, the assumption is the treasurer has the sole discretion to make these decisions, right?
Yes, and which is really not the way. I mean, look, I get that probably in every office, everybody has to interpret the law, right? And there can be valid arguments over like what does this law mean. But I think if you're doing that, the thing that you certainly need to do along with it is let people know how you are interpreting the law. You need to explain what that policy actually is, because there are people who are foreclosed who don't come into the office because their property is already taken. So they never even try. And then there's people that show up and try to get their property back and they're told no. And then there are people who come in maybe with the right story at the right time, right, to hit somebody's emotions or there's a witness. There was a story the other day about a woman in a wheelchair who had lost her home for $5,000, went to the treasurer's office, was crying because they told her she could not get it back. And a businessman, as the newspaper article put it, overheard her crying, learned the story, plunked down $5,000, and received, got her home back. And there are other people who've tried similar things and been told no. So what is the policy? This is not like a speeding ticket where it's like, yeah, he was going 50 and a 45, but I'm going to let him go. There's a social mori around this. This is literally people losing homes and property. And that needs to be very clearly tracked and made fair in the chain of title so that everybody has the same opportunity. And if the system's not working, then we need to work on changing the law, not hiding the fact that we make stuff up just to get by.
So what do you do next?
That's a great question. I'm going to keep following up with the county executive's office. Hopefully they realize that it's absurd that with this scale of foreclosure, that the answer is there is no formal policy. I do think that part of the reason why there might be some hesitancy to share is that the county could be on major shaky legal ground. It's no light thing to take people's properties away and sell them. Hopefully I'll get an answer back from the executive or the treasurer.
Jerry, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to Nancy Kaffer, a columnist with Detroit Free Press. You've been writing about the foreclosure issue a lot recently. What do you make of this FOIA denial? Because there is no written policy for how the county treasurer decides what tax foreclosures go to auction and which ones do not.
Yeah, I think it really confirms the way it has seemed from the outside for years now. You know, I mean, you'll hear the treasurer talk about a various stories that he's heard, people who are in different circumstances, and how he's tried to help those people. You know, I was at a land bank meeting a couple weeks ago where they were starting a pilot program that would offer some tax forgiveness to impoverished residents, and the land bank staff was worried about the timeline, and he said, oh, don't worry, we'll make sure those people you're worried about don't get foreclosed on. So from the outside, it has really appeared that there is not a lot of rhyme or reason to how things are taken in and out of the auction. So it really, it's almost like, oh, hey, you know, you're not crazy. This is, what's happening is crazy, but none of us trying to examine what we're going on, we're misunderstanding. It's not the way you expect government to operate, but it is the way government has been seeming to operate when it comes to the Wayne County tax foreclosure auction.
Okay, so let's take a look at this from the bottom line. What is the big concern if the treasurer's office is using its own discretion about how to handle tax foreclosures?
So I can make a very, you know, process argument here that I think that people like you and I would be very sympathetic to, that when you have one person essentially asking people to trust his judgment and making decisions based on his own criteria, that's not democracy. There's not rules for this system that regular people know how to play by. There's not fairness. I personally believe that the tax foreclosure law, as it is works here in Michigan, is bad. I think it's a bad law. I think it needs to be revisited, but it's only fair if it is evenly applied. And if it's not being evenly applied, it's being applied at the whim of one person without any set of rigorous standards that determine who gets a special break and who doesn't. That's not democracy. That's sort of government by fiat. That process argument is I think, a good one. It's one that I feel very strongly about. But then sort of in the more, I guess, detailed ways that this could go wrong is who is getting these exceptions. There's no benchmark to measure what the treasurer says he's doing against what those outcomes are. I mean, we can look at the rolls and see who doesn't get auctioned and who gets, you know, and who does. Are these people that an elected official might know? Or are they people that they have a connection with? Is it depending on If you can get the ear of the treasurer, are you able to get an exemption? You know, how are you getting the ear of the treasurer? And this is, again, me sort of generally speculating about the ways that this could be unfairly, particularly unfairly applied. You know, is the treasurer who says he wants to help vulnerable Detroiters stay in their homes, you know, what is the balance between, in his mind, vulnerable Detroiters and, for example, businesses or landlords or absentee landlords? Like, we don't have a matrix to understand why he's making these decisions, so we can't evaluate them.
Right. The complaint being there are a lot of these LLCs that are mm-hmm. owned by foreign corporations or out-of-state corporations. Mm-hmm. They buy the property, it sits, it deteriorates, and there goes the neighborhood again. I want to get back to your statement about the tax foreclosure laws in Michigan being bad. Tell me why you think it's bad statewide.
So in Detroit, I think that we have a very unique situation because we've had such disinvestment and such population loss in the city that, to my mind, the value of an occupied home, the value of someone living in that home, doing their part to keep the neighborhood together, keeping up that home, even if there's someone who lives in poverty, with the resources that they are able to put into being a part of the fabric of the city, outweighs whatever meager tax dollars that you're going to wrest out of this modest property. So to me, the math doesn't make sense. We're displacing this home, we're going to sell it at auction, and in the process, we're further deteriorating the fabric of our neighborhoods. That to me is what really doesn't make sense about this law as it plays out in Detroit and Wayne County, is because it's just really different conception of the value of land. Statewide, I have concerns about how the law is structured because there are the state law allows treasurers to charge interest on back taxes and fees. And in a lot of counties around Michigan, not just Wayne County, but in Macomb County and other counties up north, counties have started to look at these foreclosure-centered revenues as sort of a, oh, look, here's a pot of money that's coming in that we can use to bond out for roads. We can use to put into this project. There's been some ways in which this is now seen as sort of an exciting pot of money. But that's not good government, because you don't want to fund county operations off the misfortunes, i.e., falling behind on your taxes, of its residents. It's like the goal should be building this functional fabric, not trying to get money out of people who don't really have it in the first place.
Nancy Kaffer is a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Lester.
We reached out to a spokesman for Treasurer Sabri to offer a chance to respond on the show and discuss the issues Jerry Paffendorf raised. That spokesman responded, quote, "We are doing everything we can to keep people in their homes. We declined the interview," end quote. Coming up, a judge in Detroit has been honored by Equality Michigan for his work on a case involving violence against a transgender woman. We'll talk to Judge William McConaughey next. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, Democrats in the Michigan House of Representatives announced legislation that would reimburse people whom the state wrongly accused of fraud. The Unemployment Insurance Agency used an automated system to detect fraudulent claims. The agency ended up falsely accusing tens of thousands of people of fraud, garnished wages, seized tax reimbursements, and caused all kinds of financial havoc on a bunch of Michigan families. Here to discuss that are this week's political commentators. John Selig is CEO of Lansing public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He was communications director for two Republican attorneys general, worked in the Michigan's governor's office and with the legislature. TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs. That's a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. All right, John, so how did this software end up falsely accusing so many people of fraud? And why didn't some staffer at the Unemployment Insurance Agency step up and say, hey, I think there's a problem here?
Well, you know, that's one of the million-dollar questions here. And one of the attorneys involved in the case, I think her name's Jennifer Lord, she's pointed out that the use of artificial intelligence, computers, can run amok. And we really got to keep an eye on that. The flip side is government needs to move forward. We hear a lot of things about how the state of Michigan technology sector is about a billion years behind schedule. So where's the balance on that? But the clientele, the taxpayers and the families of Michigan were the ones that paid for it in this case. So we got to learn a lot of lessons here.
You know, John, under any other circumstances, now this all happened under the Snyder administration,
any other circumstances, this would have been front page for days and weeks and months on end. But we had the Flint water crisis. Do you think this issue did not get enough attention because of the other issues during the Snyder administration?
Well, I was going to say, I think this is something that does rival, or if not fall into a very similar category as Flint as far as a debacle goes. But certainly that one got tons of more attention, became an international issue, Flint did. And so this issue did not get as much attention as it should.
TJ, there are lawsuits in federal and state courts. Why would the Democrats in the House want to reimburse people before we know what happens in the courts?
I think Democrats in the House believe, rightly so, that the state of Michigan has to make right this debacle. There's no other way to put it. You know, more than 1,000 people here were directly impacted and forced into bankruptcy, forced into negative credit ratings, forced into, you know, paying additional dollar that they didn't have to pay. You know, and regardless of if the state reimburses them or not, I mean, we're not even talking about the legal fees that they have to incur, the damages you have when you incur a bankruptcy, and really the mental strife that goes into impacting families. I think the state of Michigan has an obligation to make this right. The UAA fund certainly has the money in it to make it right for these people who were impacted. And as John said, this is a sort of a catastrophic circumstance of what happens when we rely too much on artificial intelligence and not on real people making real decisions.
I understand what you're saying, that the Democrats would like to make these people whole, but why don't we wait and find out what the court system does first?
Well, I think people have waited long enough. I mean, these cases have been dragging on for several years. I think the state case is more than 4 years old. The federal case is a couple years old. While the legal wranglings go on, you know, people are still suffering a negative impact on their lives because of a state screw up. And for me, that's something that is not forgivable. We can't wait for these federal cases to move through courts. The state knows it's done wrong and it needs to make it right.
You know, Lester, I think there's a lot of confusion out there about how come the Democrats who took office didn't just settle this case. You know, the Republicans, Rick Snyder, Bill Schuette, they were fighting to protect the state. During the election, Gretchen Whitmer and Dana Nessel were saying that this was a huge problem. This needed to get fixed right away. But here we are a year later, and the pundits and the observers are looking, saying, look, they're fighting the same battle. Why are they doing that? Well, there's a lot of things going on here. Number one is there's a lot of lawsuits and a lot of messes to clean up. Number two, running for governor is one thing. You could just say, I'm going to do X, I'm going to do Y. But then when you get to the governor's office, they not only hand you the keys, but they hand you the responsibility of the budget. And if Gretchen Whitmer has plans, she wants to fund education, she wants to fund roads, there are all these lawsuits where a judge could decide for her, no, all your discretionary spending is going to be spent on these cases, making these people whole. That's a problem. That's why I believe you see them continuing to fight the case so they can try to win it their way and then clean up the mess their way.
I've got something else I want to ask you about, John, but while we're on this topic, TJ, you know, since the Democratic Attorney General and the governor's offices are still fighting these lawsuits, do you see some incongruencies here since the Democrats in the legislature are saying, hey, no, let's get this fixed?
Well, you know, certainly I think the governor and attorney general have a lot on their plate. But again, it's important to point out here that, you know, we're not talking about general fund dollars that would fix this problem. There is money in the UIA system to make people whole. And I think House Democrats recognize that. And, you know, we have a surplus in this fund and there's no reason why we shouldn't be moving to expedite this case. I do think, though, to John's point, maybe Lester, your point you're making, which is, you know, when you sit in those chairs, when you sit in the, you know, when you're governor or attorney general, you have to look at what happens when, you know, when you reimburse people, you know, when a lawsuit is pending, what kind of precedent do you set if you pull the trigger too quickly? But at the same time, you know, these are real people who are struggling through bankruptcy that they shouldn't have been forced in the first place. I believe the state has an obligation to settle this before these cases are finished.
John, these false accusations and penalties by the state against these people have been known and acknowledged for some time now. Why hasn't the state, especially Republicans in control of the legislature, who tend not to like government overreach, like allowing AI to go after a bunch of people who did nothing wrong, why haven't the Republicans said, here's a way we can make these people whole?
I think, first of all, what we have to look at is the initial part of making people whole was refunding all the money the state took back and the penalties and the interest that went along with it.
First step.
That apparently has taken place. So it's not as if nothing has been done. But frankly, the second part is the victims exercised their right to file lawsuits. And once those lawsuits went into place, we've seen this over and over again, everybody just goes on to hold because we have to see what will be the result of the lawsuit. A judge may decide how these people are made whole instead of our elected leaders.
Which brings us to the original question, and I'll ask both of you again, why are the Democrats doing this? I mean, if we're still waiting, why is this just a symbolic move? And are the Republicans going to move on something like on these proposals the Democrats are making? TJ?
Well, I don't think it's a symbolic move at all. I think that there are Democrats in the House who are tired of waiting for this process to go on. And again, it's one thing for a case to take a year or 2 years, but some of these cases are more than 4 years old. And that's 4 years of people, you know, grappling with the real challenges and the real box they've been put into because the state screwed up. And I think that I don't think it's rhetoric at all. I think it's a real attempt to make people whole. And I think that as the state of Michigan owes these people that they've been wrongly accused. We've said that in, you know, many articles about this over the years. And I think it's high time that we do something about this. And I'm proud of the House Democrats stepping up and trying to make it right.
John, is this legislation going anywhere?
No, it's probably not. And what's important to look at, A, is what it exposes is a split between the House Democrats and the governor and the attorney general. The governor and the attorney general on one side fighting the legal battle to protect the state interests in the long run. The House Democrats can propose pretty much whatever they want because, A, they're in the minority. And B, love it or not, we've entered campaign season. And they didn't propose legislation that solely focuses in on making people whole. They also kicked the door open and said, let's also blow up and expand the unemployment system overall. And basically what they're doing is setting up their weapons for the election so they can say the big bad Republicans didn't lift a finger to help people who needed it.
So you don't think any Republicans going to step over the aisle and say, yeah, you know, let's hurry this along and make these people whole?
I think there's a lot of Republicans who want to make sure that people are made whole, because if they put themselves in the same shoes, that's what they'd want.
John Selleck is CEO of Lansing public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He was communications director for two Republican attorneys general, worked in the Michigan governor's office and with the legislature. TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs. That's a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
Last summer, at a gas station in Detroit, a man approached a woman to make some kind of lewd remark. The woman informed him she was transgender, and the man started arguing with her about her sexual identity. He ended up pulling a gun out and shooting her in the shoulder during a struggle. There were several charges filed, including ethnic intimidation based on gender. The judge who allowed that classification is Judge Bill McConico. He was recognized for that by Equality Michigan, which gave him the group's Catalyst Award. Judge McConico joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So there are no protections for people in the LGBTQ community in Michigan, at least not in the state constitution. Explain why the ethnic intimidation based on gender was important in this case.
Well, just to give you a quick history, when I was in the legislature, I introduced legislation that would add sexual orientation to our hate crimes legislation, which is our ethnic intimidation laws, our Elliott Lawson, which are employment discrimination, and we introduced a bullying bill, and we wanted to add protections for the LGBT community. The bills were never even taken up, and so we are one of the only states that has no protections for the LGBT community in our state. And because of that, we have some of the highest incidents of hate crimes and intimidation going on. And when the individual was harassed and ultimately assaulted and shot in the city of Detroit last year, if it was under the status of her being transgendered, there would be no extra protections. However, because there was dispute over her actual gender, I use the gender, and there are protections for if someone is targeted because they're a woman or if they're targeted because they're an African American, that there are special hate crimes legislation already in the books for that. And so I extended it in that case and used gender, because it was because of gender identity that she was ultimately shot in that gas station.
Well, other transgender people have been attacked, presumably because of gender, yet this was the first case to tackle it as a hate crime. Why do you think it took so long to realize that ethnic intimidation could be based on gender?
Well, I will say that Jamie Pyle, who was a special prosecutor that was brought in for this case, she came up with the theory, and she was the first prosecutor to push that. And the argument was salient. The argument made perfect sense, and I adopted her argument. It is something that, because of the rash of attacks on transgendered individuals in the city of Detroit, a special unit has been created to tackle those crimes, because we've had a rash of incidents in the Wayne State area, the Palmer Park area, where transgendered individuals have been murdered, have been assaulted, have been sexually assaulted, and the crimes were going unsolved. And I believe because of that, there's now special attention by both the Detroit Police Department, the Wayne State Police Department, and now the special unit in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office.
What do you think this case will mean for transgender people who are beaten or shot or otherwise assaulted in the future in Michigan? Is it precedent setting?
Well, that's what we need to happen. So the case, and I knew when I made the decision, it was going to ultimately go up to the Michigan Court of Appeals,
right,
and most likely to the Michigan Supreme Court. And so if my ruling stands, then there's going to be a blanket coverage and some help and some peace of mind. When hate crimes legislation was introduced, the rash of race-based incidents went down. And so I believe once, I don't want to call them defendants yet, but once people who are targeting gay and lesbians or transgendered individuals know that there are extra penalties that can come, I believe the crimes will go down. So it's going to be up to the Court of Appeals and ultimately the Michigan Supreme Court to uphold my ruling. But it was important that I started the ball rolling.
What was your reaction when you learned you'd receive the Equality Michigan's Catalyst Award?
Well, for anyone who knows me, I'm not often at a loss for words, but I was humbled and I was speechless, because, you know, you make decisions as a judge not for recognition, but you do it because you feel you're doing the right thing. And, you know, I've fought for, you know, I'm not a member of the lesbian or gay or bisexual, transgendered community, but, you know, I'm an African-American male, and I know how it feels to be discriminated at times. And so I believe any discrimination is bad. And so I've tried to fight discriminations wherever I could find it, and that I was recognized for it. Again, it was very humbling. And it just, I mean, I have to say, I was kind of excited.
Judge William McConaughey of the 36th District Court, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The future of transgender rights in this country could come down to a U.S. Supreme Court case right here in Michigan. On October 8th, the High Court will hear arguments in three cases, one of which is about a transgender woman who was fired from the funeral home where she worked in Southeast Michigan. Join us on Monday when we'll talk with Amy Stevens and her lawyer, Jay Kaplan, from the ACLU of Michigan.
Unfortunately, it's all too common. Transgender people disproportionately experience discrimination, particularly in the area of employment. And either they don't get hired for a job or they get fired from their job because of who they are, for trying to present and be their authentic selves on the job.
That story Monday on Stateside. And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Well, let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with another episode of Cheers to Michigan here on Stateside. What do you have for us today?
As you know, Lester, we have a book coming out based on these spots here on Stateside. And I was looking back through the book, kind of getting ready for that, and it inspired me to make a cocktail based on the very first cocktail we ever made on Cheers and the very first cocktail that's printed in the book.
I remember what that cocktail is, actually. It was the last word because I was so excited because it's a big, big Michigan cocktail, Detroit cocktail.
That's right. It was invented in Detroit before Prohibition and then disappeared off the books until 2004 when it was rediscovered. And one of the things that made it so appealing to cocktailians at the time is that it was a really adaptable recipe and you could do a lot of different things with it. The original calls for gin, but you can substitute in pretty much any other kind of spirit and you still get a great cocktail. That's what we're going to do today is we're going to make a riff on that original, and it's called The Final Ward, and it was created by a bartender in New York called Phil Ward.
How does it differ?
So instead of the gin that's in a last word, we're going to have rye whiskey and then...
That's good.
And then instead of the lime juice, we're going to have lemon juice. And then it keeps the green chartreuse and the maraschino just like the original.
Well, let me take a taste of this. Okay, so this is not very much like the last word, but at the same time, it's got a lot of the flavor notes of the last word. That rye changes everything, it seems to me. So how did you make this?
Well, it's that combination of the rye and the lemon juice, I think. And those things, if you think about it, we tend to use lime more with gin and lemon more with whiskey. And so we're really kind of playing on those complementary flavors here. So it's really simple, just 3/4 of an ounce of each of those ingredients I listed, combined in a shaker with some ice, shake it up really well, strain it into a coupe or a martini glass.
You know, what I really like about this is it's a riff on the last word, as you mentioned. When we debut the book to the public, it'll be at the Last Word Bar in Ann Arbor on September 10th. Kind of seems fitting.
It all comes full circle, Lester. Cheers.
Cheers. Still to come, we'll talk about the transformation of Detroit's riverfront from industrial abandonment to a gathering place for all to enjoy.
Oh my goodness, we have peregrine falcons, osprey, bald eagles, lake sturgeon, lake whitefish, mayflies, and even beaver.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It wasn't that long ago that Detroit's riverfront was little more than aging industry, abandoned buildings, and parking lots. Today, the Detroit Riverwalk is always improving. A new book by John Hardig chronicles the history of the Detroit River and those recent changes. The title is Waterfront Porch. Sitting near the water with him, I started by asking Hardig what the Detroit River would have looked like before European settlement.
Think about the Detroit River as a connecting channel where all this water from Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, and Lake Huron flow through the Detroit River down to the lower lakes. But early settlers and Native Americans would have seen coastal wetlands, you know, a lot of wetlands along the shoreline, a nice riparian buffer habitat, and then lots of wooded area back then. So probably very much different than we have today.
Over the years, there were docks and wharfs built, everything from commerce to shipbuilding, and slowly the city began to encroach upon the river. So where would the river actually flow if we were going through the same place today?
So if you and I were walking along the Detroit Riverwalk, or even inland from the Detroit Riverwalk, on Atwater. Atwater is maybe, on some places, 1/4 mile in from the Detroit River. So why did they call that water? It was at the water. So they took fill material from one of the forts in Detroit and put it in there. When the Great Fire of Detroit occurred, they put all that the rubble into there. And so you can imagine they filled these places along the shoreline with anything and everything. It was a working river in support of commerce and industry.
That continued for a very long time, more than a century. By 1948, I believe it was the year, there was a really cold winter that year. The waterfowl came, the ice was over the river most places, but there were a few places where they could land. What happened?
Yeah. So for millennial, you know, the waterfowl on their migration come south, and they head. And along the Detroit River, we have wild celery beds, especially for the ducks. And they would come in search of that because they need food for energy on their migration. So it's a spot to rest. It's a spot to feed. So it was a cold winter day, and there were only a few pockets of open water. And this is now right after World War II, and there were no industrial and pollution controls on industry, and oil was coming into the river. At that time, they estimated 5.9 million gallons of oil and petroleum products were being discharged to the Rouge and Detroit River on an annual basis. It takes 1 gallon of oil to pollute 1 million gallons of water. To put that into perspective, that was enough oil, 5.9 million gallons, to pollute the entire western basin of Lake Erie, all Michigan waters, all Ohio waters, all Ontario waters. So there's only a few pockets of open water. What's in the open water? Oil. The ducks come down, land, and 12,000 ducks and geese died in one event. And a group of duck hunters from the lower Detroit River who cared about it picked up those oil-soaked carcasses of ducks and geese, threw them in their pickup truck, drove to Lansing, Michigan, threw them on the sidewalk leading to the state capitol, threw them on the steps, went into the capitol and said, "How dare you do this to the place where we're raising our families, where the place we call home, the place where we recreate." Those duck hunters now, fast forward, are credited today with starting the Industrial Pollution Control Program of Michigan.
It was a long haul, though, because this happened again in 60 and 67.
We had two more massive ones. We have a difficult time learning from history, you know, and we don't always do a good job of that. So we had to learn it back again in the 1960s and ratchet up regulations and have stronger enforcement programs. But then it started getting better after that.
Well, let's flash forward a little bit. It's a dark and dreary day, as you describe it, in the 1990s, or in 1990. You're in a window of the Renaissance Center taking a look out at the river's edge. What do you see?
You see first three sets of cement silos towering over the Detroit River. Then you see material storage piles where freighters came in with aggregate and limestone and salt. And then you see surface parking lots, and you see abandoned and dilapidated buildings. What a sight of just almost like a post-industrial waterfront that certainly underutilized, right? No public access. And how can we have that occur in this major city in the United States?
But you saw more. You and others saw more. You saw possibilities. What did you see?
We saw, just as going back to Mayor Pingree in the 1880s, you know, he wanted a linked riverfront parks project. There were lots of attempts, but none of them successful.
I should say that Hazen Pingree was probably Detroit's most popular mayor.
Most popular, did so much for so many, you know. And so it was our time, you know.
Why didn't it happen in that 100 years in between Pingree's proposal and the 1990s?
The perception of the Detroit River is that it was a working river in support of commerce and industry. They didn't think environment like we do today. And environment, natural resources were an afterthought. They weren't a priority. But today, now with a cleaner river, people rediscovering it, oh my goodness, we have peregrine falcons, osprey, bald eagles, lake sturgeon, lake whitefish, mayflies, and even beaver. We have six beaver dens. And an amazing turnaround, one of the most remarkable ecological recovery stories in North America.
And this is after almost all of those animals were extirpated from this area.
They were literally all extirpated. Bald eagles and peregrine falcons and osprey tried to nest. But for two decades, because of eggshell thinning, because of organochlorine pesticides like DDT, Myrex, and Dieldrin, and things like that, they couldn't produce young. I mean, so they didn't survive, but they are back and they are flourishing. And people on the Riverwalk get to see these.
Well, let's talk about the Riverwalk, because that has been a recent development. You are one of the people who actually saw the possibilities. And, you know, there are hundreds of people involved in this, probably thousands of people involved in this. We're not going to go through naming names through all of it, but how did that all come together?
So with the cleanup of the Detroit River and with strong interest in the public sector and the private sector to revitalize Detroit, you know, people started saying, well, why can't we have public access, greater public access to the Detroit River? And so momentum was building. And then a number of things happened. General Motors purchased the Renaissance Center, and the front door of the Renaissance Center was Jefferson Avenue. And it was this big, almost like a fortress kind of building. So they turned the front door of the Renaissance Center around and made a five-story glass atrium called the Winter Garden. That is the new front door. UAW-GM Training Center, one of the largest training centers in North America, offered up a riverfront greenway. 2001, the tercentennial of the city of Detroit, put a historical marker for the Underground Railroad on the waterfront with a sister one right across the river looking at each other, both looking at each other. So this all came together in an unusual way that gave the city confidence to move forward with a Blue Ribbon Committee and gave the public and private sector the opportunity to form a partnership and come together, create the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. And the foundations then, like Kresge, gave the single largest gift in the history of their foundation at that time of $50 million to kick it off. So that was the catalyst. It was a confluence of several different things, and not, I can't point to one thing.
You mentioned that the Detroit Riverwalk is being built as sort of a necklace, with the strand of the necklace being the Riverwalk itself, but there are beads along the way. What do you mean by that?
The beads are some really cool places, like Mount Elliott Park, with a sunken schooner in the land with water cannons, and it's free for all kids and families to go and to enjoy the outdoors, to fish there, to play in the water park. And there's you've got Gabriel Richard Park, you've got Cullen Plaza. What's coming is the new Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Centennial Park. So these unique destinations on the Riverwalk are the beads, and then the strand is of course the Detroit Riverwalk.
I want to talk about the Milliken State Park just a little bit, because it's a natural area right in the heart, or right on the, as you say, the waterfront, the front porch of the city.
Yes. So when we started that project, to get the state interested, there is no state park in the city of Detroit at that time, right? So could the state, the Michigan DNR, build something there, a state park, that would engage people and be almost like a gateway to state parks throughout the state? So in the early planning phase, you have to dream, right? And say, what's possible here? Could we collect stormwater off of Atwater, off some of these parking lots, instead of it going into a storm sewer, which just goes right into the Detroit River, could we put it into an innovative stormwater treatment system where there's a deeper basin where it comes in first and some of the heavier things like sediment settles out? Then it goes into sort of a emergent and submergent marsh area where plants take up nutrients and clean the water naturally. Then it goes into the Detroit River. But most importantly, this would have a really unique shape, and it the Riverwalk would undulate along it and go over it, and kids can touch the water. And so now you get to see muskrat, and you get to see red-winged blackbird, and you get to see all turtles and frogs, and you can get up close with it and reconnect children with nature.
You mentioned the Milliken State Park was the first state park in Detroit. How are we going to get people who live in the city to get involved in natural resources?
We need most people in urban areas, Detroit and other places, are disconnected from the outdoors and from natural resources. One of our goals is to reconnect people with the Detroit River and with wildlife and give them a compelling experience that is fun. They might learn something along the way, hopefully inspire a sense of wonder. Today, 80% of all the people in the United States and Canada live in urban areas. Where's the next generation of conservationists, environmentalists, sustainability entrepreneur going to come from? It's going to probably come from urban areas. We are placing a high priority on inspiring a sense of wonder and a conservation ethic in the next generation so that they can not make the mistakes that our generation made.
You mentioned the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Centennial Park. Right now, it's been used as a concert venue a couple of times. But what are the far-reaching plans for that area?
Far-reaching would be to think of our history. We talked about it a little bit as Detroit River being a connecting channel. And so it's like a lot of it has concrete breakwater and steel sheet piling. So it's pretty straight and then curves on the bend of the river and goes down to Lake Erie. But there's not a lot of places where fish, young fish, can get nursery habitat, can go into a cove and rest and feed maybe a little bit on their journey, either up to Lake St. Clair or down to Lake Erie. So we're going to do a cove, a 3 to 4 acre cove in there, which was like a little embayment off the Detroit River. And in there will be a beach where kids can touch the water, go in and swim. There will also be wetland habitat, riparian habitat. There will be some soft shoreline engineering. So it'll be a net gain in habitat for the river as well. Then this incredible opportunity to engage kids in all of that, in learning. So there'll be learning stations. There'll be this playscape. There'll be two pavilions, one for like basketball and outdoor recreation and another one with food and restroom facility, and all then connected to the Riverwalk and connected up into the neighborhoods.
Now, your book, Waterfront Porch, is ostensibly about the Detroit River being open to residents again, having access to it. But the last section of the book talks pretty optimistically about connections to places like Campus Martius and the Eastern Market. Tell me how this all works together and why the riverfront is important to it.
One of the greatest things to happen was the DeQuinder Cut, to think about that. And this is a below grade, that means like sunken down, and it was a rail line, right? And so they were able to acquire half of that. Half of it they want to keep so they don't preclude future options. They could still have some light rail or something along there. But half of it went and build a connection, an immediate connection to Eastern Market, to Midtown, Wayne State University, and the New Center area. So all of a sudden, you connect all that. And the usage of that is amazing, you know, right now. And that is a foretaste of where we're going. So Joseph Campo, that ends up at Stroh River Place, that's the next one you're going to see. It's the same kind of thing. It's sort of like, think of a tentacle coming off the Riverwalk and going into the neighborhoods to reconnect, you know, children and families back to the Riverwalk. And then there's another one coming called May Creek that'll go up from Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Centennial Park and head towards the Ford, the old train station, and go into Mexican Town. So what a great way of connecting people back to the river and making places that are very special for both people and wildlife.
John Hartig is the author of the new book, Waterfront Porch, Reclaiming Detroit's Industrial Waterfront as a Gathering Place for All. Thanks for meeting with me.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it, Lester.
We sent Stateside's Tad Davis to the Detroit River Walk to ask people what they think of the changes on the riverfront.
The changes that's happened on the riverfront is good for bringing in new people, I like that, you know, people can walk around, and I like the multiculturalness of it. But I feel like the people that's native to Detroit, they don't actually get a chance to see the changes that's happening to downtown Riverfront because they are not informed.
It's absolutely beautiful. I come here every Friday at 6 a.m. I get the sunrise. It is fantastic. There's so much going on down here. They have free yoga in the summer. They have a wonderful reading program for kids. It's just a good deal. You go to Mount Elliott Park, they got the little water park. I love the feeling of the greenery and being out in the open. I love it here.
A lot of African-Americans don't come down here like that. The African-Americans that you see down here, they come from other cities. The African-Americans, so-called, are still back there, and they've never felt welcome down here back in the day. But now so much to do and everything, they can come down here with no problem, and for some reason they won't. You know, so it's a mindset. Then you got people like me and that's accepting this and knowing that we have to grow.
That was Del Rio Le Courtier, Mary Davis, and Michael Newsom sharing their two cents on the changes made to the Detroit Riverwalk. That's the show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.